That's easy. Well, let's have a look at Creedence of the Summer. Is there any points, by the way, you don't get, you know?
Yeah.
Like, put them down on a piece of paper or something, you know? And we'll have a go at this next time, okay? I think the aesthetic humour is important enough, don't you think? I mean, to spend some time on. So, Lindsay, bring your Stevens in next time. We'll have a look at Creedence of the Summer, and I'll try and give you some information about the prose essays, particularly the Necessary Angel, and some of the stuff in the Opus Posthumus. You see, where to look. So, like, bring the credences, okay?
Yes,
right.
Yes.
Bye bye.
Bye.
Yeah. I'm working off my guilt, too, actually, about this, because I've got a feeling that I've never really done well as Stephen Sussex. I've always found, I don't know what it is, I've always found that the resistances just stop me reading, I think. You know, and I think I've been very silly. Actually, really blind, you know. And I'm just about being able to see it now. But it is difficult, isn't it? I mean, it is difficult, isn't it? I'm with you. It really is difficult. I think you've got to watch every move. It's certainly not the poetry to like to read quickly or expect to. I mean, you must understand that that like partial reading of the aesthetic humour is like pro tem as far as I'm concerned. Really, I mean, it has to be. But I really think I've got the gist of it. I honestly feel I've got what's going on in this thing. I don't think the gist is difficult. Right, exactly. That's why I like giving you the gist. I think that one way of handling Stevens, particularly when one doesn't have all one's life to do it, is like you don't have the ideal nightmare of joy to them, the ideal reader, you remember, the ideal, not nightmare, what is it? What is it when you can't sleep?
Insomnia.
Remember Joyce's Miles Bradford? His ideal reader was the man with the ideal insomnia. He said, one filled his life with Finnegan's Wake. And it's a bit right for this kind of poem that you could go on and on with aesthetic humour. But I do think that finally there is a steady structure inside this thing. You know? I don't think that it is endless analysis here.
Yeah, the man that's great. Not only the man who can't sleep, but the man who can't be put to sleep.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm just asking what he was up to. Demanding that reader. Yeah. But I think of all the poets I know, Wallace Stevens is the one that I've been inclined to be impatient about. I mean, impatient in that sense that I read superficially and then got mad by the amount of detail I was supposed to take in. You know, now I feel the opposite, but I think that the amount of detail is difficult, but worth it.
I'm convinced that Wallace Stevens is going to become easier to read
right.
as time goes on,
right.
as these things become part of one's equipment.
Exactly. I think that as the 20th century moves on and we understand the demolition of big systems more and more, and the whole humanistic idea, and the whole idea of what leisure is going to be, you know, central rather than work. This is the big switch that's taking place now. The major dislocation is taking place right now, that the measurement of human beings by what they do in terms of work is stopping. I think that Wallace Stevens is like a futuristic thing, and it's on that he's like projecting ahead quite a bit, the best he can. I think the nervousness is that you find in his verse, like the angularities and trickiness and like overwriting. There's an awful lot of it. And as I say, at the end of Aesthetic Humour, where he gets his rhymes in and these sounds clashing together, he's trying to make finals, you know, coming on. Like he's saying like a grand finale. But I find one can only put down to nervousness of a poet living in a time of disaster. You know, imagine the mentality of a man like this who's living through, like, you know, two world wars, the crash, and like the Mongolian invasion, and the advent of Hitler and Stalin and so on, you know, that kind of thing. It must have come to, particularly if he's a man of some wealth too, it must have come to continually that his act was in some way so individualistic as to be renegade. You know, It must have come to a man like this, there's certain treachery in what he does. Do you see what I mean? Because, I mean, particularly the weight of the rest of poetry. I mean, we think of the Wasteland, particularly, and all those 30s poets, Auden and so on, you know, who go head on to confrontations continually with disaster, don't they? Do you see what I mean? And one wouldn't be a bit surprised if a man like Stevens was unnerved quite a bit by finding himself unable to do that and wanting to do something else. I felt maybe there's a little bit of courage going on here of this kind. But there is a, as I said, there is an elephant side of it, and that is repetitive. Certainly, I mean, taking a poem like this, taking a masterpiece like this, and reading it is one thing, but reading through objective poems is a bit unfair, but you I find that it's all much of a muchness, it's very similar. You know, I think one must say that as well. Although I do think that it's I'm trying also to get rid of the stress that I've put on the past and that I think I've been mistaken. But a lot of people are still doing that, like on the notes towards the Supreme Fiction. You know, I think the title sounds kind of something you can teach. I think this is right.
And the association of fiction and supreme is very right. Attractive.
Right. It sounds like, well, there's something that I think is a deep forget. I think the man with the blue guitar, because like, you've got the Picasso image, that tends to be overestimated. You know, it sounds good. And certainly when you're looking at the black version, it's set to music. And it sounds like philosophy anyway. So I think we've all been sidetracked. I think we've got to look at poems like the Tethys come out, Creeping to the Summer, and Sea Surfaces Full of Clouds, that one, you know. Another one. I forgot where it is now.
Ninety-eight.
That's it, yes. 98. That kind of poem. Quite an early one, but it's some interesting things in here. It's quite long, as you see. But it's the luxury area, Florida and the Caribbean. This is where rich men like Wallace Stevens would go for the summer holidays. Well, there's not about summer holiday poetry in this collection, which is like, you know, all right, because it's the leisure time. Well, it's a good time. And it's this poem is very sensuous. About the word paradise or green, phrased paradise or green comes up. Once again, he's at his old job of imagining paradise. I think it's very beautiful, I must say. But there's also a lot of that stopping him of what this kind of stuff makes you resentful is, you know, who can afford holidays in Tantefec and Florida all the time, Miami and so on, and then everybody comes surging in this way. The letters, I'm afraid I don't know. I haven't even touched them. I took one look at that, I don't know, 600 page volume and decided that I'd have to put that off later. Have you looked at them at all? No. Now what I'd like to do is what I was doing for the Keats letters the other day, where you were being, just lay off the important ones. I must do that sometime. Read through, you know, see what's going on. The basic thing I have got off them is that he never moved outside America, which is a bit curious. There's an enormous correspondence with people all over the world who sent him gifts. So his house is full of very exotic things. Just very curious. As if he was like on the receiving end of pleasure continually in his life. From all parts of the world. And then he writes back to people, like thanking them again and again and offering them like a bit of context for it. It's a very curious motion, I noticed. I mean, I've just glanced at them. I just did notice it. But there's a lot of them. I've got time.
You know, what Stevens does with images suddenly makes me think of my grid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
It's a deceptive something that looks like symbolism but isn't.
Yeah.
The emphasis on the object, and this sort of superficially quiet, placid exterior that isn't at all quiet and placid.
Well, I think next time we look at this, I mean, the passage that one has to look at, and I have had hope to lead toward it today, but I didn't get there. And that is where it says, and this is like dead in the center of what's going on now, is trace the gold sun about the white sky without evasion by a single metaphor. It's Creedence of Summer, section 2, verse 2. And say this is the center that I see. You see? And that's what's happening. I mean, as I say, Creeley is writing like this. Olson, that is. Let's put it in question form. What is it when human beings want to make metaphors and similes of environment? Is it possible not to? Well, Stephen says yes, it is. And that's what poetry should be about. You know, well, it should dramatize the fact, huh? The poem should be instances of clarification at this point, basically. This is his main thing, at least, huh? And as I say, it's why Olson's maximus verse pile up facts. It also relates to what I was saying in our institute the other day, you know, about feeling morphology. Facts before thoughts. Henry Adams, right there. It is this going on now. Right? We're inheriting at last morphological ideas of relating facts and leaving them like that. But notice he says, look at it in its essential barrenness. And one feels, you know, that if you use a word like that, there's still like a hidden down inside. There's all the thing, my God, just how much we're giving away, you know, getting rid of. I mean, you're giving away virtually, practically everything that human beings have ever done, in terms of like myth making, religion making, philosophy making, story making. Yeah. That's why it is barren, in that sense. You know, that's why he's honest about it. So one has to say, trace the gold sun about the whitened sky. Without evasion by a single metaphor, we'll stop. Look at it in its essential barrenness. And say this is the center that I see. So I don't think Stevens is saying it's easy or something like this. You can just like plunge in and drop a lot. And it's true. It's true indeed, isn't it?
You're not. Sorry, I didn't catch that.
I think it's very true. I mean, I think that I would be very. I mean, I feel like I think I know what that barrenness means. That it to do only that, I think, would be impossible. You know, I think that it must be possible to take pleasure in what you're discarding, knowing that it's fiction. I think. You know?
This is very much the way that Margaret talked about symbolism and the way he got angry when people tried to interpret and make stories out of his paintings.
It's very difficult. I mean, because after all, I mean, okay. Margaret's basic idea is to dislocate objects from environment and place them in their usual environment and place them in another one. So in fact, for instance, you see a rock, a huge rock, suspended over a valley in which it is not falling, obviously. And the rock is exactly the same kind of rock as the size of the valley, which is my favorite Margaret painting. Like the, what is he saying? He's saying an act of pure imagination. I've always thought Margaret is very limited, by the way. I don't think he's a great poet. He's a great artist, good thing. But I think that his act of dislocating customary relatings going on between weight, colour, sound even, I think eye gouging is very easy to do, and is really evading the main issue. I mean, I put it like this, I find Max Ernst better. Max Ernst seems to be the major artist, because he is making radical analyses of myths all the time, and creating new ones, and saying, look how easy it is. You know, and this is like, this is really undermining and exciting. I feel like my great seems to me to be someone who is a big bourgeois painter. I mean, he plays games with dislocations, no more. Very limiting thing to my life. Very limiting indeed. They're like jokes that you've heard once, and then you know very well that you're never going to laugh at that one again, or you won't laugh at that time. Yeah. Like once you see those shoes which have toes, I mean real toes, you know what I mean? It's like a joke. Or you see that dress that's hanging on the wall and it's got breasts, and real breasts. And all these, you know, all these tricks, they're tricks to my mind, John. I don't think they're symbols, I think they're tricks of dislocation. Okay, as far as they're anti-myth-making, maybe, yes, but I find it very limited, you know?
There were things in that exhibit that really knocked me over, I must admit.
But I wonder what. Another one I like very much is the way he's got this house with the lights on in the daytime. That's weird. It's in its own bit of darkness. It's really curious. But, you know, that's all. It's just odd. It's like conjuring tricks. It has the same kind of fascination.
Maybe I apply to the literary kind of interpretation to it, but that rape picture of the man growing out of the woman's body gets to me.
Yeah. I don't know, I find nothing happens ever. I mean, it happens again a second time. I mean, like, you look at that railway train coming out of the fireplace, and let's have a look at this railway train coming out of the fireplace. You think, okay, well, it's hanging on the wall, but it doesn't mean anything to me at all. You know, it doesn't.
It means something to me, but.
Well, the railway train coming out of the fireplace?
I ain't talking.
Oh, wow. That sounded like I'm maybe lacking on two cylinders. This is always a strategy of the psycho. It's like...
I'm not talking.
What?
I'm not talking.
Yeah, right. Okay. If you're going to sit there, All right? You know, like...
You
should do
it with
Dave Murray. Yeah. Poor old Dave, what a shame.
Those Nazi jazz musicians, if you got to ask, you'll never know.
Right. Yeah. But certainly, this demolition of symbolism is a really interesting thing. So, I'm sorry, I have to handle very carefully this... It's like a radical change. Because as soon as that word metaphysical crops up at the end of Aesthetic Humain, they're radically challenged, the metaphysical, by the actuality of this warm August summer day. The whole of that structure of comparisons. One thing with metaphysical actions. It is metaphysical, in fact. If that's going to be discarded, an awful lot. And it's like James Joyce said, was Parrish worth that mess? Remember that terrible punchline? Was Parrish worth that mess? This is a marvellous pun in Finnegan's Wake, when I, you know, him as the fifth of Navarre, when you saw like the Balfour Massacre of St. Bartholomew, and like this is, which stemmed from his own conquest, says, was Paris worth a mass? And like Joyce is using like Paris's food, which is like a thing to, it's both a tonic and I think makes you shit. Right, so he says, was Paris worth that mess? To me, like, that's what that means, the language. That isn't symbolism. That is like multiple layers of like, and that's something. You see, that's the kind of thing that Stevens is up to, like, you know? You see what I'm saying? I mean, structures of language which are inclusive may expel symbolism. So that you have a field structure built on the page. You know, like, this is what James Joyce is doing in Finnegan's Wake. Again and again, it isn't what the critics say. It really isn't. Like palimpsest and like, you know, and so on. And Joyce said it's a verbi-voco-visual structure of the word. What he meant was like you verticalize meaning until you have a spatial area of sets inside the sentence. I mean, when he said, like, you know, she was young and easily frightened, it's still not symbolism. Obviously not.
I've always thought that the pun was vastly underrated.
All right. Yeah. But provided it can spatialize meaning into a simultaneity, you know, so you have a simultaneity of action, then it's valuable. If you have a simultaneity of action, you don't have to have symbolism relating it up, because it's there like that.
I wish we're
I'm reading a new book, recently came out of McLuhan, called Through the Vanishing Point. And he's been writing this for a long time with Harley Parker, who is the assistant curator of the Toronto, Royal Toronto Museum. I think I told you about this when I went to the museum and they were playing this marvelous exhibit. I was their first victim. They were planning an underwater and seashore exhibit in the museum. We know about McLennan's idea that museums are ridiculous, we shall have them in glass cases. And they should be like verbi voco visual, tactile. So they had this marvelous thing, it was for the kids basically, I don't know why they tried it on me. But certainly they must have seen that as an object here. You first of all move into this very dark area, very gloomy, or underwater effect. But it's a very dark green light coming from somewhere. And then with lots of models in little caves around, and it's very slightly chilling, of undersea creatures, and close television films of large fish all around you. It's a queer little thing. Then you go up this ramp at the end, and to get yourself up, you have to hold on to these sides, and they're like immediately the tactile thing is, because they're like shells and pieces of rock in the sides to hold on to. And as you go up the ramp, you break the photoelectric cell, and a huge wave breaks over you. They're on the screen, which you haven't noticed, it's so dark. And a big roar, you go up through the shore. And I said to him, it's one thing missing, like, you know, the smell of ozone. He said, just get it, make a note of that. I'm like, my God, what have I done to these poor kids? It was marvellous. I mean, just think of the fun those kids are going to have. Beautiful idea, isn't it? You know, like, they're going to really have an opportunity to go keep close to things that they can't keep close to in any other way. Because you can't see anemones in such good condition. You can't see underwater things, you know, in that way, by the sea. You know, you just can't do it.
Being all encircling, it's a kind of a nose dome.
Right. So this is the title of their book, and that's called Through the Vanishing Point, you see. It's a huge collection of pictures with a common text about what perspective means and how you break it. And this linear point of view. And how it's disastrous.
Is this book available?
In America, it's available here. been out for about, it's been out now for about, just over a year. I just haven't had time to read it, but I'm reading it now.
Is that false till it doesn't bring up?
It is, it's very much so, because it's suggesting, you know, that all those things in that book where he's suggesting that that linearity and so on is a clue to it. And he's now transferred the whole thing, which he doesn't do in that book, to the visual art. Like, what is the, you know, what is the illusion of linear, of your eye following lines of space in a painting towards certain points, which are the vanishing points? What sort of painting would it be where the vanishing points aren't there? So the transformation point will be the point at which people start painting without vanishing points. And the answer will obviously be Mondrian. And paintings of circus, you see. Or like the one I was talking to you about the other day in the Institute course, like these huge canvases in America now, so big you can't see them. I mean by that they are, say, 68 inches by 50 something, and all one turn, a single turn. Now you can't see them because the farther away you stand so you can see the whole framework of the thing, the further away you get from the surface, which you can't see. And the nearer you get to the surface to see it, the more your eye cone will take in the space. You see? So you can never see it. Well, like at the Camden Town exhibition at the moment, have you seen it? And there's a marble sculpture, which I think 28 feet long, and is white on one side and black on the other, in a room which is very dimly lit. And you can't see it all at once, it's impossible. You see, it's like breaking this idea of you see things from a point of view and you see all of it. And the arts are like, it's like Pierre Boulez's music is like this, you know, or like, as an artist, that you in fact you can't hear it, all of it, but one, it's not possible.
It's this Niels Bohr thing again.
It's a Niels Bohr thing. They've all done. I mean, Xenakis uses the theory of gases composed by it, and that is that that Niels Bohr's idea is you can't possibly know science. You can't even know the science of atomic physics. You can't even know your own field of atomic physics because there's so much information happening simultaneously. As soon as you don't look at it simultaneously, you can't see it. So give up the word all. That's some more all of this. But this is what McClellan's doing in this book, this, to the vanishing point. At least he and Harley Parker were working it together. I don't know who came, who was primary. Is to ask questions about visual space. And the description of visual space. So there's passages from Yeats and Chaucer and so on, and poetry, as well as the painting. All those places where people are describing space.
Does it connect up with Gombrich or Kepish?
Connect with Kepish quite a bit, but not Gombrich, I don't think, very much. Gombrich is more phenomenological. You know, that what you're seeing may be seen in two ways, like his famous duck. But the... McClellan is actually going beyond that. And that is that, what does it mean if you're moving into an environment which doesn't ask you to look at it? Just ask you to be in it.
Yeah.
You see, kind of thing. And this is happening all over. I mean, plays in America now mostly, and over here a little bit. You're not asked to be a spectator. This really is. And people make jokes about it and laugh and scoff and so on, but he's one of the few men that knows exactly what the relevance of atomic physics and the theory of relativity is. You know? And I've never been able to understand all this scoffing. Have you? I mean, it beats me completely. There's lots of, you know,
it's
sometimes
it's self protective in one of the things.
Maybe, yeah.
If you've invested so much. You hate to see the market collapse.
Yeah, right. And that's all. I suppose that's all it is. Rubbish. But I mean, the way, you know, particularly academic gatherings, the word of the term, everybody's supposed to snicker, and they do.
you know, it began to irritate me quite a bit. Because it means, I don't care what those damn little farmhouses do themselves, they're kids is what worries me. You know, they're preventing the students from getting access to things, aren't they?
You're underestimating the
students
a bit there.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I find that students, like, do in fact take all of the. I mean, they have so much to do that anything you invite them to select is a tremendous influence. Do you know what I mean? I mean they've got particularly 3 years in this translation in English department. I mean, you know, but you were here in English department, you know. I mean, this thing, how much you're supposed to get to. But anybody who says, look at that, then look at that. It's bound to get your vote more. I mean, even unconsciously, it's bound to operate on you. Do you not think it's, you know, this is the danger of it all.
Yeah. Thank God that's something I don't have to worry about. Is the reaction? It is.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
I don't start off with the sermon. And stick around in maybe more than anything else. Okay, well, hey, nice to see you, man.
Yes, you definitely have some more students.
I will. I'm going to finish off 3 dishes of summer. And but I want also to look at some of those processes. Like the, what's going on in some of the things in the office posthumous essay and in the Necessary Angel.
When are you going to write a poem again to us? Is that what's all next?
That's at the Institute.
I thought you were doing it on the third year course. I seem to remember on one of those typewritten sheets.
That's an institute course.
That is an institute course.
Yes, that's an institute course.
Can I get into that?
That's easy. Anytime. 10 o'clock Thursday.
Yes.
We discussed it. We said you couldn't come.
Yes, I remember that.
Sorry about that, but it's all taped.
Well, it's just possible I might be on strike by then. We're on next Thursday as well, by the way, so I'll probably get down to the second year thing.
You're out all day Thursday?
We're out all day Thursday, yes.
Well, don't come to the Institute next Thursday, there isn't one.
No.
Thursday morning.
You're lecturing here Thursday.
Yes, I will be, but Thursday morning.
3:40.
Yes, right. What are we on? I've forgotten.
Emerson.
No, we've done. We did him last week. Sorry, it's Wald.
Sorry.
Yes. But the Institute, there isn't one next Tuesday, next Thursday, because we have one of our annual meetings with the whole setup.
Yeah.
So I've had to cancel my
seminar. You're on strike as well. Are we getting very militant in Camden, Marvels?